Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 136, with guest, Real World Theology contributor Amber Kennison, and from Norval Rogers and probably every other podcast you listen to, J.R. Forresteros. So listen up, because we've got a really exciting show for you. On this episode, we talk Wonder Woman and bad Greek mythology. Actually, if the internet has told us anything, you don't actually have to have seen this movie to have an opinion about it, a very strong opinion about it.
So, for two separate reasons that have combined. One, because it is about feminism, and two, because it's about superheroes.
So you would say that people will basically form opinions about movies just because they're superhero movies, period?
Oh, yeah.
Is the Batman versus Superman kind of thing? Like it's going to be
is the fill in the blank every superhero movie ever thing?
Yeah, people are already telling us that Thor will be terrible because it's a Thor movie and things like that.
Because the trailer is too similar to another trailer you really liked like, that you ended up liking the movie of.
Well, I think it's great because it obviously sparks internet discussion. The more discussions we have, the more space we have to enter those discussions and hopefully turn people into real world theology or you know whatever we're doing. We all have. Online projects and things that we're involved in. We can all hopefully steer people into better conversations. But, you know, there's always a bad side of it where sometimes you just can't get through to anyone. And that's unfortunate. You said something that was interesting to me, JR, and I'm kind of curious what the rule is for this. Because you said one of the reasons is because it's a superhero movie. One of the reasons is because it's like feminist or it's about feminism. Like, why is it about feminism? Is it just because it has a female lead, or is like what makes it about feminism? Is that all that qualifies it?
So, my favorite short definition of feminism is feminism is the radical notion that women are people too.
I don't think I had heard that one.
Well, so we have. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say, I'm sure that JR could mansplain it to you if you're not familiar.
No. My goal is to get through this whole thing without mansplaining anything.
That's actually my goal as well.
So you have one superhero movie in the dozens at this point, even if you only start counting from Iron Man.
Yeah.
That is explicitly about a female superhero, one. And yet somehow it has sparked all sorts of outrage. I think, and it has a female director.
It's the first one ever. And I was reading about this and I slacked you guys. I think I sent that to both you guys.
Yeah. But,
I mean, it was talking about kind of the history of superhero movies and really if you go back and kind of consider like when the first superhero was made, we've had 97 years of superhero movies. And this is the first one directed by a female director.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
which is insane.
Come on. I mean, yeah, it's insane.
And it's only the third one that's about a female superhero, and that's if you allow both Elektra and Catwoman to count as heroes when they're very much anti-heroes in the comics.
Yeah. I mean, and nothing to say against the women themselves, but the films themselves were barely movies. So,
well, when they're not written very well, then there's not much that the actress can do.
So what you linked, I think, hit on a really good point in that it was it's not necessarily just that they're written poorly. It's that they're written for a specific audience that doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, that's that young male audience. So they're all over sexualized and stuff. And you're already going to have lots of these, this young male audience who are antagonistic to a female superhero. Unfortunately, for cultural reasons, whatever, you know, for whatever reasons, they're already going to be antagonistic to it. So you're automatically cutting out all of the other base of people that you could be not pandering, but targeting this movie towards. And it just feels like you're completely missing the mark. So I wanted to start out with a question that I would not normally ask because it's almost on the nose too much. And a lot of times when I have people on podcasts, it's because they're very interested in the film or they have history with the subject matter, et cetera, or something like that. In this particular case, it's probably no secret that I was going to go out of my way to make sure that I had at least one female guest on the Wonder Woman podcast. And I'm very glad that
Hello.
You're here. Yeah, I'm very glad that you're here, Amber. And so my on-the-nose question, to put you on the spot is, what does this movie mean to you as a woman? Like, just so we can get this out of the question. Way. Like, 'cause I want to know.
Okay. Let's see. Well, starting with just kind of my like first reaction to it. Literally when we walked out of the theater, I went and saw it with my sister. We walked out of the theater and I looked at her and I was like, okay. So one, I loved that and I want to watch it all the time. two, I was like, that movie, it makes me want to A, train harder and B, be a better person. Like, I want to be a better person and I want to train harder. And I've been training harder this week. I'm not sure if I've been a better person or not, but.
And Amber, I know this because I creeped on your bio. When you say train harder, you mean Muay Thai, right?
I do mean Muay Thai.
That's awesome.
Did you show and up this Friday. Week with like bracers on?
No, I wore my Wonder Woman shirt.
Yes.
To my Muay Thai training class. I'm not even kidding.
Did people instantly fear you? Like more than they normally do, probably?
No, but so it was a mixed class. It was a co-ed class, men and women, mostly men. My partner was a woman and she was like, oh, I love your Wonder Woman shirt. And she was like, I want to partner with her. And then we actually like did these, speed drills at the end. And, you know, I'm kind of a competitive person. So when he told us at the beginning, like, oh, the record for this week was this many kicks in 20 seconds. So I was like, okay, I'm going to beat that. So not only did I beat that, I beat all the dudes in the class. And
yes.
I think it was a shirt.
They were probably all wearing like Superman shirts or Batman shirts.
One of them was wearing a Spider-Man shirt.
Oh yeah. He's just a little kid. He can't do anything. He's not mythical. Well, okay, so you're saying...
I wanted to be a better person, too.
Yeah, so you're saying, or, well, at least what it sounds like you're saying is that this movie was incredibly inspirational to you.
Yes, I found her so inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I could kind of get into what somebody was talking about with, you know, the earlier DC movies, which, admittedly, I haven't watched yet, actually. I haven't seen Man of Steel or... Batman versus Superman.
You're good.
But from what I've read, you know, they were trying to kind of, you know, bring their heroes down too much and kind of do what Marvel does with the Everyman becoming greater, but like the DC heroes are supposed to be already great and they're coming down to help us and they're supposed to be inspirational.
Yeah.
Or aspirational even. So I felt like this with Wonder Woman, they definitely did that right. You know, she's this like wonderful role model that we can look at. Be like, hey, you know, yes, she can fight, but it's certainly not all about fighting. You know, she shows love and kindness to everybody around her all the time. And she sees good and she chooses good and she chooses love and it's all, it's all wonderful.
No, that's great. Like, so in my quick review on Letterboxd, I basically wrote down what I told my wife when we left the theater. And I said, I can't really even explain it, but especially during like the first third of the film, I really just was sitting there wishing that I had a daughter that could come to that show or to come to the movie with me and watch that, because it felt so different and so oddly inspirational to, like I said, and like I said, I feel like I was struggling over my words to explain it to my wife. And my wife was agreeing, and she was kind of saying, yeah, I get that. And she was talking about how she was inspired, and she was kind of like, she's like, I was tearing up during the fight scenes. And
I teared up more than once for sure.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, but tearing up during the fight scenes, that seems so random. She's like, I don't know. She's like, it was beautiful and empowering. And, you know, it was just watching, she was talking about, like this mixture of strength, kind of woven in with compassion. And, I think the reason that I had these feelings is because I was like, you know, I want a daughter that I would raise to grow up and say, hey, look, this is what it looks like to not be focused on always the end game. It's being focused on people above like everything else, when that loving, compassionate, and then not just being like, what I think women are often typically portrayed as is like, oh, you're deeply passionate, you're deeply caring, you're deeply empathetic, but now the men need to go take care of the situation. She was both. She said, I see a problem, right. I am moved internally, and then I am not just moved emotionally, I am physically moved to take action to make the world a better place. And I was like, ah, this is what I want to impart in a generation of young girls.
Yeah. And that's why, I mean, I can totally see, you know, tearing up during, you know, the no man's land. And I mean, this, I was going to save some of this for my favorite moments because come on. But the whole no man's land thing, you know, they're in the trenches and she finds out what's going on. And Steve's like, come on, we got to keep moving. And she's like, no, but there's this problem. And they are so, and part of it is her kind of freshness in the situation and her sort of outsider's perspective, because they've been so beaten down by this war. You know, they've been at war for 4 years already. And it's like, you know, this is the way war is done. This is the way you stay on mission. This is the way you get things done during wartime and all this stuff. But she's free of all of that kind of baggage. And she's like, you know, she just says, no, there's a problem. I'm here now. I'm going to help these people. I'm not going to let them, like, I'm not accepting this situation as it is. Yeah. You know, because they're like, you know, we've been stuck here for months. This line hasn't moved. You know, you can't go out there. You know, they're all just saying can't. She's like, no, you can. So she's this sort of, you know, irrepressible optimist. It's like, no, we can do this.
So, and JR, we'll eventually get to you, but
I'm sorry, JR.
I am happy.
So the other piece of the perspective on what this means to you personally, and I want to admit that I don't expect you to speak for all women, but
oh goodness, yes, please, yeah, no.
But I do. I am very concerned, or not concerned. I'm very interested in hearing your perspective on it. Is, you know, we've talked about like kind of how Wonder Woman has inspired you, like the character. And her character traits have personally inspired you, but something that we were kind of dancing along the edge of at the beginning of the episode was, and I'll pull some numbers up, like only 7% of directors, 13% of writers, and 20% of producers are women, and men outnumber women in key production roles nearly 5-1 in filmmaking. So what does this movie mean to you as a woman from a production standpoint?
Yeah. Living in LA, like I, you know, and being in the business, like I'm very aware of that and have been since coming here and since film school and all of that. And you know, it's the same across the board with different forms of entertainment as well. You know, films, animation, games, it's all still very much a man's world. There's progress being made for sure. You know, even in the past 10 years, it's gotten a lot better, but you know, we've still got a long way to go. So this is, I think, a big step because, you know, there's, and like in an article I said, it talked about this, you know, that, you know, there's this concern that, oh, like, you know, movies with women, you know, not just superhero movies, but movies with a woman as like the main character, oh, they just don't make as much money, or they don't do as well. But, you know, I think, and then, you know, the female director and her being at the helm, which I think was amazing. And she, like, I hope she gets so much props for this. and she has, and I hope that continues, in the form of, you know, awards and everything like that. But, where was I going? It's really huge. Like, this is a big, and I think a lot of people were looking to it as a kind of test to see, like, okay, is this gonna do okay, or is it gonna be a big mistake, you know, kind of thing. But from what I read today, they're talking a sequel already, and that's happening. So yeah. I'm very excited about that. So I'm hoping that will be the start of a larger trend. And greater faith on the part of the studios in female higher creative roles and female execs.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that either I was reading or we were discussing, not us, but I was discussing with some people in our discussion group, was the idea that when a male director makes, like, tanks a film or has just a terrible film, it's not necessarily like a death knell to his career. Like,
oddly, no.
Yeah, they still let them make. Yeah, they still let them make movies. They still hire them as directors.
Because there's lots of factors that could be involved in a movie failing when it's a male director.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's a female director, there's clearly only one thing that could be the problem.
Right. It's like, oh, it's because there was a woman. That's why. Mm-hmm. No. It's like, okay, so every other factor that's involved in this massive business suddenly becomes irrelevant.
Well, and
how does that work?
So that's one of the things that was actually concerning to me, seeing how almost all the lead up to it was, we're not sure the right woman was cast for Wonder Woman. You're finally giving a woman a shot at a superhero film in the director's chair. Knowing the history the recent history of the DC universe. And like I said, it's not that there's no one that doesn't like Man of Steel or Batman versus Superman. It's a little bit harder to find anyone who likes Suicide Squad, but, with that
history. Oh my gosh, I forgot about that one. I didn't see that either.
Yeah. So with that out there, like I'm sitting there being personally concerned, saying they're putting this, they're finally giving this opportunity to someone, to a DC universe that has been critically already dragged through the mud.
Right.
So something I'm curious, especially since you've seen all the lead up films or the tie-in films, JR, is how much pressure was on DC to get Wonder Woman right?
Well, I mean, we can joke all we want about how you can make a bunch of bad movies and they will keep making them. But they were burning bridges. I put up my very positive review of Wonder Woman on Friday morning after I saw the film Thursday night. So for opening weekend, it was spoiler free. And I had four different people over the course of the weekend, four or five, actually, I'm trying to think now, tell me that they had no plans to see the movie until they read my review was so positive.
Mm.
And they were there were people that had seen the other films. And they said, you know, DC, I lost all faith in DC. Like, they clearly don't know what to do with these characters. The movies are terrible, blah, 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 blah. And they've been very pleased with Wonder Woman. So, yeah, I mean, if Wonder Woman had been another dumpster fire like the previous three films have been, I don't know what they would have done with Justice League, which is going to be a dumpster fire, like, for sure. Because Zack Snyder was still at the helm of it, and he hates everything that's good about DC characters. So,
but it's okay. Joss Whedon came in there for, like, you know, the very last week.
For the end.
And right. I'm sure he fixed all the problems.
Yeah.
Even though DC assured us that he did nothing.
He fixed all of the problems that are woven into the DNA of Zack Snyder's take on superheroes.
Well, okay, so I have been on the anti-Zack Snyder train for, you know, since basically Man of Steel. And I have to say, one of the things that I can't criticize him about is the fact that, one, he is probably most responsible for casting Gal Gadot.
Oh, right. I did read that.
And he was one of the, he was one of the guy, one of the two guys behind the story for the, this Wonder Woman movie. So he had his hands in this film as well.
And I think you can tell where his influence was, which are in some of the film's weaker moments for sure.
Mm. Why are you going to hate him so much? You know, it's a bad, it must've been Zack Snyder. It's good. It couldn't have been Zack Snyder.
I'm happy to make my arguments when you're ready to talk about the final act of the film.
Well, I mean, that's probably what I would point to as well. I mean, I think the part of Wonder Woman that people point to as the weakest is the part that's probably most like the other films. Unless, of course,
the part that resembles two action figures being smashed together by a toddler. Yes.
which, like I said, is probably what a number of people, not everyone, because again, I know that there's probably people listening to this show that really like, especially Batman vs. Superman, and even more so Man of Steel to a different degree, but that is the thing that reminded me most of those movies. It was the third act. So knowing what you know now, Amber, having seen Wonder Yes. Woman, does it make you more interested to go see these movies that you haven't had a chance to watch yet?
Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman?
Yeah, and Oscar award-winning Suicide Squad.
And Oscar award-winning Suicide Squad.
Yeah, I don't know about Suicide Squad, y'all. But, you know, I wanted to see Man of Steel when it came out, and I wanted to see Batman vs. Superman. I just never got around to it.
Mm-hmm.
Even after hearing all of you hate on those two movies.
What?
Yeah, that never happened. So I don't have the loyalty to the comics. I didn't read the comics growing up. I of course love those characters. And the Dark Knight trilogy is mm-hmm. like one of my favorite things ever.
Yeah.
But knowing that they're not going to be awesome, I will probably watch them at some point. just because, I still enjoy visual effects. Fun, and I was watching Wonder Woman, I was if the visual effects in the other movies are anything like this one, I will probably at least watch them and enjoy them for that,
Visual effects have never been where Snyder struggles.
Yeah.
I would literally watch it just for that and not really expecting a stellar story or, kind of going into it with a fairly low bar. Well, just being I just want to see some fighting and some explosions.
Well,
and if somebody could throw a tank like Wonder Woman, that would be great.
You get that in at least the last half hour of Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
Right, Mikey? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually something that I would be very curious. And maybe this is something that you can just pass along whenever you do have a chance to watch Batman v Superman. Knowing that we're all now kind of in love with Wonder Woman, in love with this great character. It was goosebump, hair standing up, inducing kind of cool to watch Wonder Woman show up in the final act of Batman vs. Superman as in costume, ready to kick butt. Her theme music was amazing, and she was awesome. But that was because we had not seen her at all.
Right.
So now you have a movie where you've seen what she can do. I'm wondering if that would actually diminish her showing up in BVS.
Ooh, intriguing.
It is clear, having seen Wonder Woman, that she was holding back in that fight at the end of Batman v Superman.
Well, okay, So, JR, another question I have for you, because Amber, I think you've basically answered this already, is almost backing up, what did you see when you watched Wonder Woman?
First of all, I saw a really fun character. Multiple fun characters. So mm-hmm. so I'll say three things that really stood out to me about the first time I watched it. One, they managed to strike a nearly flawless balance with her character of innocence without naivety. And maybe it's just because I recently suffered through Netflix's Iron Fist.
Yep.
Where they should have had a similar balance and utterly and totally failed on every conceivable level to do that. And so completely ruined one of the great comic characters in Danny Rand. But they did it so well with her. And I think the stakes were even higher because Steve Trevor could have ended up mansplaining Europe to her.
Yeah.
Right.
The modern world. Right. And it never for a second felt that way because she never came across as stupid. She was fish out of water, but fish out of water and smart is fun. You know, it's a really fun storytelling device. And I thought she nailed it. She mm-hmm. never ever felt like she was overwhelmed. She actually felt like she was joyful or a little bit disgusted, mm-hmm. like with modernity, you know? And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Can I speak to that a little bit?
The
innocence aspect and the fish out of water thing too. I had what was great about this one, because I heard the criticisms about the earlier DC movies, was that, like, you know, DC was thought like you couldn't have a sense of humor. Like, you're not allowed to have a sense of humor in a superhero mm-hmm. movie. And what I so appreciate about Wonder Woman is they did not feel that way. And there were a lot of funny moments and great bits. And one of them was when she first enters the modern world and they're, you know, like, we got to get you some new clothes. And she's first, you know, first thing she tries on, she's like, how do you fight in this?
They're like, well,
you don't. She's like, no. She rips half the stuff she tries on. But to her innocence, as I started thinking about that and the kind of the sort of childlike innocence that she has, or the joy in, you know, an ice cream cone or snow that she's never seen before. It reminded me too, that she, even though she wasn't an actual Amazon, she was like half Amazon, half goddess or whatever. She's the only Amazon who was ever a child.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All the Amazons were just created by the gods as they were, and she was the only one who was ever a child. So I think that sets her apart even in her own home culture, because I don't think that take any other one of those Amazons taken out of Themyscira and placed in the modern world would have acted the same way.
I think I'd buy that. I would say that they would probably be more set in their ways. They were like, this is, which is, I think, what we get from her mom and most of the other kind of warriors. They're like, you need to do this thing. It's very cut and dry with all the characters. Like, this is how it is. This is my answer to it. Whereas Diana just kind of seems to always be open to new ideas and learning and engaging with different situations. Which I think was also great. And I think part of that helps with exactly the thing that you both are talking about, because one of the first questions that I got after the weekend, I guess, I'm trying to figure out exactly when this question came in, but it was like a Saturday, Sunday kind of question. Someone was like, hey, you remember when we talked about this in the discussion forums a while back? And it was that video, called Born Sexy Yesterday. About how, especially in sci-fi films, there's always this incredibly sexy woman who shows up and she doesn't know anything about anything. And everybody has to explain it or take care of her. And she's so naive. And it's kind of like this male power trip thing. And while maybe not quite as bad in some situations as it might be depicted, it is definitely something that would be very hard to argue against, that is a trope that draws in male viewers. So it's one of the things that I struggled with when I left, when I was leaving the film, because I said something about it just didn't feel right. Like it was really odd to me, because, you know, she kept having to be led around and she kept having to have things sort of explained to her. But at the same time, I didn't feel like it was totally like Born Sexy Yesterday, because they didn't make her dumb. They
she's not childlike.
Yeah, she's not
naive.
Yeah,
right.
She thinks differently. Things are new. But yeah.
Right. She's taking care of business. Like they're telling her how things work, but you know, when they're even like the first time they were like attacked in the alley, you know, dude tries to shoot Steve Trevor and she just blocks the bullet with her, you know, wrist guard, whatever it's called. And he's like, "All right."
And then she beats up
all of them.
Four of the five of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then Steve Trevor punches out one guy.
Yeah, he lands one punch at the end.
So as a side note to that scene, did everyone notice that was basically like a reversal of the scene from, is it the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeves?
Oh, see, I wouldn't know. He catches that bullet
or whatever and saves Lois Lane while he's as Clark, you know, and did his reverse. Oh, so cool.
I think also the scene where they're on the boat. And she's like, "Why don't you come sleep over here?" And he thinks that she is naive,
mm-hmm.
right? That she doesn't understand, like, that could be taken as, like, sexual contact. And in fact, when they finally almost get around to saying it directly, she's like, we decided we don't really need men for pleasure. And, like she knows. Like, she doesn't have the experiential knowledge of it, but she's not an idiot. And mm-hmm. she knows what it means for a man and a woman to lay down next to each other or what it can mean. Mm-hmm. Right. And she's just, you almost get the sense that she's messing with him, you know? So I think
when he gets weird about it, I think she does.
Right. Right. And I think that deconstructs that trope, right? Because all of a sudden he's the one that's being messed with, not her, you know? And if you compare that to something like The Fifth Element, where she is like barely verbal, like she is explicitly childlike
mm-hmm.
throughout much of the film, and Diana just never came across that way to me mm-hmm. except for the scenes that she is a literal child.
Well, I think if anything comes the closest thing that comes to being the born sexy yesterday kind of trope, I think, is actually again reversed with Steve, like, basically trying to figure out what's going on, like, and he shows up in the pool and is just like, "Oh, everything's glowing." Like, he looks like he ends up being
looks high, right?
Yeah,
like he's like
he looks like a born sexy yesterday kind of character. Like, he's half naked. He can't believe, like, how wonderful and magical the world is. Like I said, I'm glad they didn't keep him that way, because I don't think it really helps to just make born sexy yesterday a male version. Because it doesn't help.
You know what I like in that scene too is, yes, she's explaining things to him, he's explaining things to her, and then she's challenging some of his notions. Like when they talk about time and why he has a watch,
mm-hmm.
she doesn't understand why he needs a watch. He's like, "You let this little thing tell you what to do?" Like, kind of challenging. Just kind of our modern, you know, our day-to-day lives are so structured around what time it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we can kind of obsess over that, how many minutes things are taking. And, you know, it's kind of a commentary, too, about that in modern society, I think. And so it was fun to see her kind of challenging that modern notion that just something we take for granted and is so embedded in our day-to-day lives. And, you know, she kind of almost takes a philosophical view. It's like, why do you need to know what time it is? Like, why is that so important?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you let this thing tell you what to do?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that kind of points to, I think, one of the second thing that I really appreciated as I was watching through the movie, which was that Steve Trevor was undeniably a sidekick, but he never felt, I never felt like he was being represented as somehow inferior. And so again, as a feminist film, right? Feminism is not women are better than men.
Correct.
Feminism is we are all equal and equally worthy. And so there were plenty of times when Steve did whatever he could do, but he was always following her lead. And I mean, literally, whether he was trying to drag her out of a room where she wasn't supposed to be allowed, or trying to calm her down after she had, like, told off whoever, you know, the general,
right,
or basically, like, arranging for her to fulfill his promise to her, to take her to the front. Like, he was always supporting her, but he felt he felt totally competent, like, and totally awesome. It was just that he is a human and she is a demigod, you know? And I appreciated that. Like, as a male viewer, I didn't feel like condescended to, or again, it wasn't like a feminist movie where it's like girls rule, boys drool. It was just like, hey, here's an amazing hero who happens to be female, you know, by and large. I mean, there were still a few moments here and there that were a little less that, but right. By and large, well, I thought it was just incredibly well done.
Yeah, and I would absolutely agree. And, you know, I just want to say, like, as a woman, I appreciate that too. Like, you know, for me to feel empowered, I don't need a movie to show me a woman who beats men down, you know, like who belittles them. Like that's not great for the human race. Know, like I don't enjoy that.
I think it's what the DC heroes are supposed to do when they're being used correctly, and this is what Zack Snyder totally fails to do in every conceivable way and fashion, which is that when you see a DC hero being them, it makes everyone feel bigger because they're mythical and they're calling us to the best versions of ourselves. And with Steve and his ragtag gang, which is actually the third thing I want to talk about anyway, with him and his ragtag gang of misfits, all of them had so much emotional baggage.
Right.
And I think my favorite moment in the entire film is when they're getting ready to head out the third day. And Steve says, you know, it was a 2-day thing. You guys did 2 days. I'm going to keep my word. And Chief and Samir say, oh, you know, we know Diana's fine, but who's going to keep an eye on you? And then Charlie says, you might be better off without me. And she just looks at him and says, but Charlie, who will sing for us?
Oh, that was one of my favorite moments.
It like invites him in as something other than just the killer, right? Like it calls him to create beauty and to add beauty to the world when clearly he is so traumatized by the things he has done and the things that he has seen and possibly the things that have been done to him. And she, that's what the DC heroes are supposed to do, right? They're supposed to make everyone bigger. And so I felt that was what she did for all of the characters, both male and female, was she made them want to be the best possible versions of themselves. And I think that Charlie scene was just like a masterful moment of that.
So good. And what the other thing I liked about that, about Charlie, you know, the Charlie, you know, who will sing, is that she is communicating to him that, you know, his worth is not in his utility, you know, as a marksman, as a soldier, you know, it's as a human. And I just thought that was really beautiful. Like, hey, you're not just our hired gun here. Like we want you around. And then after that, he can't stop singing. It's great.
That got, both times I saw it, they got a huge laugh in my theater where they fade to the woods when they're in the woods.
And he's still singing out the top of his lungs.
The other thing that I just loved about this little band of misfits was how diverse they were, without commenting on it. Like, it didn't have to be a whole thing. Like, we had an Arab actor, I think he's actually Moroccan, and then we had a Native American actor, and then of course Gal Gadot is Israeli. Did y'all see the article that's been going around about the actor who played Chief, Eugene Braverock?
I saw that there was one. I did not read it.
It's really tremendous. But basically, he sort of like insisted that he be allowed to sort of create his own look, and it would be one that drew from his. He's Blackfoot, so it would be one that drew from his culture. And then when he introduces himself to Wonder Woman, he speaks in the native Blackfoot language, which I mean, that's like unprecedented, certainly in a superhero movie, you know. I don't know, I just thought that was a beautiful moment. I loved that they took pains to represent him so fairly. I just thought it was awesome.
Well, I mean, because she talks back in that language, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's one of the bajillion languages she knows.
Which, if we're gonna, if we ever talk about the mythology of the DC universe, I want to come back to that.
Well, so I love that you guys are both like honing in on this, because there was something that I couldn't shake in a good way, and that was that it seemed like Wonder Woman encouraged everyone that she came in contact with to be better versions of themselves. And we talked, or you both have mentioned how it's been pointed out that DC characters are not necessarily supposed to be relatable, but they're supposed to be inspirational. They're not like us trying to ascend. They're these pictures of idealistic, I don't know, awesomeness that come down to shine on us and give us a better way to live. And it's obviously happening outside the movie context on, in a personal way, but it's awesome that they showed that in the film, you know, with Charlie, that she's showing that people's worth, it's based in community, or it's communal, it's not functional. You know, the whole reason that, I'm sure there was some relationship there, but Steve was picking these people. He was picking Chief and Samir and Charlie because he points out, this is your function. This is his function. Like when he's describing them to Wonder Woman or to Diana, he's saying, this is a marksman. He's like, he can talk his way out of everything. Like, they're all functional roles, thinking very like stereotypically like a male, like, how can I get the job done? How can I fix the problem? And she sees way more than that. She sees, hey, you know, I realize that you have a job, but you are also this human being, and I'm going to encourage you in your humanity, which is primarily communal more than functional. And we see it with the secretary. Like, it's like everyone she comes in contact with, it's one of those Jesus moments, you know, like no one meets her and walks away the same. Like the secretary, Steve's secretary, you know, she
love her.
Yeah, she comes in. She, even though she's a secretary, she doesn't feel like a secretary you'd see in most movies. And not only do they do a lot of great things with her, but like I said, once she meets Diana, she instantly almost becomes emboldened. She's encouraged in what she does and how she's seen. Because, you know, and it's a joke. It's like, oh, we call that slavery. And she's like, ha ha. She's like, someone is understanding. Like,
she's like, oh, I like her.
Yeah, I like her. It's like almost everyone mentioned, I think, the ice cream, you know, it like this basic thing, like this amazing ability to encourage and show gratitude for everyday things and see through the monotony, like the things that we talked about before, you know, cutting through the, oh, this is just how the world is, let's pass it by, but seeing the beauty and being handed a really good cone of ice cream, you know, like, you should be proud.
I know,
like,
that's so cute.
Like, it's, like I said, it is cute, but at the same time, it's beautiful. Because like I said, it's not naive. It's seeing beauty, and I mean, it leads up to, you know, I would say the climax of the film. Like, there is beauty in getting on a, right before you get on a train to go to war, or get on a boat to go to war. You know, it's just this really incredible presence that she had, that they were able to weave into this movie. So I want to talk about something that I have no idea where it's going to go, because I wasn't exactly sure what was meant by this. But JR, in your review of Wonder Woman, you said, once you've seen the film, let's talk about what happens with that sword and those gauntlets and how that's masculine versus feminine imagery.
That's I got that.
That's what I want to talk about. So I want you to explain that, and I want you and Amber to talk about that. I'm just gonna sit here and take notes.
Oh boy.
So there are some parts of men's bodies that some might describe as sword-like. And it is fat. And I will say, as a caveat, before we dive too far into this, I think that the actual climactic moment, I almost said climax, but that would be a little bit too on the nose, the film actually undercuts what happens before it in an unfortunate way. But swords are very phallic, mm-hmm. and the way you fight with a sword is by stabbing and piercing and penetrating. And that's all very masculine, very phallic, very sexually aggressive. It is noteworthy that probably at least half of the things that Wonder Woman does in the film are shielding and protecting. And that's historically been much more of a feminine role, shielding and protecting. And again, I found it just very interesting that the masculine weapon was taken from her, and she was told that's not the weapon. Like, you're the weapon. The woman is the weapon, right? It's not this male masculine kind of pokey thing. Like, it's not the penis, it's you. Like, that's mm-hmm. like, that was symbolically what was happening there, which I thought was just really brilliant. And then, of course, in the end, she just shoots a giant beam of white energy out of her into Ares and kills him. But, you know, can't have everything. So, and Amber, you said you caught that too.
Well, I read your review as well, and I knew exactly what you meant. You know, I studied art. I know a phallus symbol when I see it.
I mean, I didn't even see it coming, you know, because you were just told from the beginning, this is it, right? And man, like, it wasn't it.
Really?
And
you didn't see that coming? Oh, come on, guys. It was obvious that she was the weapon. That's why
I was happy with letting her wield the weapon.
Oh. I mean, it was a cool-looking sword, but, you know. Actually, so there's probably some nerd explanation. Like, what was the sword she had in Batman vs. Superman then? Was it just a sword?
I mean, she's clearly been collecting swords and all kinds of other stuff. So, who knows? Maybe we'll find out in Wonder Woman 2.
Or Justice League.
See her weapons collection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, Batman will have that scene where, you know, he, like, pushes the button and everything opens up and it's, like, bat-shaped everything. And she pushes the button and it's gauntlet-shaped everything.
Did it bother either of you that she killed Ares?
Did she kill Ares? Can you kill Ares? Who knows?
I mean, okay, does it bother you that she apparently bludgeoned him?
Apparently. Well, I mean, so it bothered me in the way that most superhero climaxes kind of bother me. You know, it's like, I'm going to prevent people from punching each other by punching this guy harder than you can punch me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, but that's a problem with every superhero film. Like, the might makes right. It's incredibly fun to watch. But it does seem like it would continue a cycle of systemic violence, because they're like, oh, well, last time Captain America punched the bad guy hardest, so we need to make sure we can always punch the bad guys harder than they can punch us.
Mm-hmm.
So it does kind of seem problematic, but at the same time, and this is kind of, well, actually, so let me answer your question by asking a question. which isn't going to help and might not give Amber a chance to answer your question, but, which is not my intention, but when I think of the problematic nature of the question that you're asking, like, did it bother me? I want to say yes and no, because I can see, like, how it would be good either way. But at the same time, something that really struck me, and I think has struck a number of people, is that this film was kind of built on Greek mythology. At least the Greek mythology terminology is being used a lot.
I would say a Greek mythology that they made up.
Yeah. I mean, like, so
that was like actually like a sort of like weird Mormonized Christianity.
Yeah. And so that's the kind of thing that I'm curious about. So since they're using Greek mythology terminology, that's about as far as I can go, because I feel like there's a lot of parallels between this version of mythology and, like, the actual biblical narrative. It seems like unquestioned parallels, and maybe that's because, you know, the biblical narrative, we could argue, is woven into almost every story in some form or fashion. But So I would
or
say,
or because DC loves shoehorning it into their movies. Looking at you, Man of Steel.
That's right. So, you know, in this one, I would love to flesh this out a little bit more at some point, and maybe in a couple minutes. But I think Wonder Woman is probably a very excellent Christ-like figure.
Based she on, does hold her arms cruciform multiple times.
very true.
But you know, you know, especially on a podcast like this, I think it would be really easy for us to just point out Christ-like figures. But I think there's a number of things that she does that are blatantly parallel biblical narrative. But to answer your question, if this is biblically paralleled and Ares becomes like a Satan, then what do we do in that realm? Like, do we not want Satan destroyed? Or... like, what do you do? You know, like,
I think it's problematic that we want Satan destroyed.
Yeah. So, like, if there was a book that was written that made us more empathetic for Satan, for example,
you stop it.
Hypothetically.
Oh boy.
No, I mean, okay. So I'm not going to try to pull an origin and say I think Satan's going to be redeemed at the end of history or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But gosh, it would be awesome if you were.
Yeah.
I just don't understand when we crave the damnation and destruction of any one that God created.
So what do you do if something that God created is hell bent on destruction no matter what? Because this comes into like the edges of just war theory, and again, Mike
yeah.
looks right.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you all read Carol Landra.
Yeah, what does she do with Ares? You know?
Well, okay, so so first of all, I don't know if y'all have read Perelander, C.S. Lewis, but he basically retells the Garden of Eden on Venus, and a human goes there, and there is a Satan figure, a serpent figure, it's the Unman, who is tempting the Eve character. And at the end of the book, Ransom, the Earthman who's sent there as God's representative, realizes that he is there to kill the Unman. Because, and it's been years since I read Perelandra, but his justification was essentially the Unman's never going to stop tempting and humans are eventually going to give in. So I have to kill him. Okay.
Gotcha.
I think what we see on the cross, and certainly this is played out in the book of Revelation, is that on the cross, Satan is defeated. And the forces of evil are defanged, and there is now no longer any condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And what we see playing out through the book of Revelation is how then Satan makes war on the church, given that he is rendered powerless in the wake of the cross. And the way he does that is through deception and manipulation. Because Satan cannot hurt those who are in Christ, the only way he can hurt us is by convincing us to follow other gods, to be other than what we were created to be. I think a much more satisfying ending of Wonder Woman would have been for Ares to, because they even set it up, right? That after Zeus hurt him, he had to rebuild up his power. And there were many, many, many years, apparently even up to and including the present, where he was not powerful enough to do the things he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he could have exhausted his power trying to kill Diana and realizes too late that nothing he does to her can hurt her. And then in the end, Ares is defeated, powerless, but still present in the world. And humanity has to cope with him as the embodiment of their potential for evil. And Diana says, I will always be here to show them a better way.
Thus being the ultimate, again, Christ figure.
Yeah, I mean,
from her paradise where she didn't.
Then,
yeah, okay.
And then there's none of this like, oh, love is the most powerful thing, except for giant lightning bolts shooting out of my chest and killing me. Other than that, love is the most powerful thing. It doesn't exclude Ares from those who are loved.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just rang hollow a little bit that she was like, I realize love is the most powerful thing. Not love for you, but love for everyone else. Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking about the other people.
Yeah. And I just, again, but again, and I was serious earlier when I said, you can tell that Zack Snyder, like Zack Snyder doesn't have the moral imagination to save anyone he considers an enemy. The only thing he can conceive of doing is murdering them in a cool way.
Mm-hmm. Is that like a cough, Man of Steel cough kind of thing?
Cough every movie he's ever made cough kind of thing.
So I think that's actually a very beautiful point. And now I wish the film would have ended that way, because I think it would have firmly entrenched the biblical parallels to, you know, Diana becomes the Christ-like figure coming down, from a place, like I said, a paradise where she didn't need humanity. She acknowledges what humanity is. She verbally says that I don't care what humanity deserves. I'm going to give them something better. And then shows a picture of, like I said, if what you were describing was the fulfillment of it, then it would have been her saying, like, yes, I believe in love, or like, love will conquer all, period. And then not just for these people, but for Ares as well.
And here's the other thing. Like, for real, all I could think about going through my head as they're talking about how awful World War One is and how evil, and this is like the most evil humanity, I'm like, World War Two is a generation away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what did it just not happen in the DCU? Like, if you neuter Ares here, if you take him out of the equation, like, do they just ignore it and fast forward to present day? Because World War II was way worse on every level than World War One. You know what I mean? And so, again, that's where I wanted Ares to remain for a story level. I also think it would have been cool because, like, that's the Marvel problem, right? Is, like, don't get too attached to the villain. They're going to die at the end of the mm-hmm. movie, you know?
Well, that's why I kind of, like, ha-ha, nudge-nudge. Like, I actually do wonder if Ares is gone. I mean, I guess it's entirely possible that he is completely gone. We'll probably know when casting happens for Wonder Woman 2, but on some level, it does seem odd that they would throw away, like, a mythological god so easily. But then again, I guess in their mythological universe, all the other gods are dead too, and except for Zeus, maybe. I don't know.
They've told us they're dead, right? I mean, yeah.
It depended on who was telling the story. Like, can we trust?
Right. It was from the Amazons directly, so.
Yeah, I mean, but it was Hippolyta. She was the one that was like, Zeus created everyone good, and we saw that you know, might not be entirely true, you know, because obviously there was badness, for lack of a better term, in humanity.
Which, okay, I have to, like, go on record here and have, like, a Schoolhouse Rock Greek Mythology Edition moment.
Please do.
in Greek mythology, not DCU Greek mythology, actual Greek mythology, it's actually the son of Zeus, Prometheus, who creates man. He's also the one who gives man fire and then was punished by being chained to a mountain and having a vulture pick out his inside forever and ever. And so it was actually a son of Zeus who created man, and it was another son of Zeus who created the animals. And then Zeus, in order to punish man for having fire, he had another son of his, Hephaestus, and Athena. So it took one god to create man. It took two to create a woman, just saying. created Pandora. And then he gave Pandora two gifts. He gave her, you know, he gave her curiosity, and he gave her a box that she was not supposed to open. And then, of course,
classic,
you know,
rookie mistake.
Yeah, what a terrible set of gifts.
And then that was the purpose. It was kind of an ancient Maleficent kind of thing. And so she, you know, obviously she opens the box and releases all of the evil and horrors that plague the world, you know, pain, sickness, envy, greed, all of that. And that's how evil enters the world. And then, you know, they close the lid, and but then they hear a voice saying, oh, you know, let me out. I am hope. And then they release hope into the world as well to give hope to mankind. But anyway, that is the kind of human creation and then the evil entering the world actual myth. Very abbreviated.
I did not know that you knew all that, which is great because I didn't.
I did research for a refresher, but.
Can we talk about what this movie has established now about the cosmology of the DC extended universe?
I would love if you.
Oh yes, because I don't necessarily know that.
Very confusing because in Marvel, the way they've done this is that the gods of Asgard are aliens, mm-hmm. right? So right. Yes, we thought that they were gods, but they were aliens. In the DCEU, apparently the Greek cosmology was basically right. And Earth and apparently the universe were created by Zeus, and humans were created by Zeus. Again, this modified version, not the right one that Amber shared with us. Are we to assume that Krypton was created by Zeus? What about Apocalypse? Hmm. Darkseid? Like, I'm so confused.
Mm-hmm. That was something
very confusing.
It's always interesting to me when films like this commit to something, because I'm like, does that actually work if you tie in everything else? Which is why I got why Joss Whedon went out of his way, at least while he was kind of overseeing the Marvel Cinematic Universe, to say that, hey, we're trying to use science to explain everything. That way, that's our base. Like, it may look like superpowers, or it may look like magic, but there's some kind of scientific explanation. We get this a little bit in Thor 2. A lot in Thor 2, when they're like, whoa. And to a certain degree, Doctor Strange was a kind of a left turn from that a little bit, but still kind of explained it away. And so they've not really committed to like a higher power structure, which gives them, I feel like gives them a lot of freedom. But DC is
Higher powers are just more powerful.
Yeah. Like beings. Like, yeah, planets, they haven't, right? They haven't, yeah. even with,
more advanced science.
Yeah, even with Star-Lord's dad, Ego, like, he is referred to as a god, but then there's obviously ways to kill gods. Like, it's not, yeah, it still leaves levels to go up, but it feels like it's hard to go up from Zeus. But then again, Wonder Woman can kill a god, so can someone kill Zeus, I guess? And then if that happens, then this becomes like Alien Covenant, and then you can just kill your creator, and then you create, and I'm so confused now. Did Ridley Scott make this film? I'm completely, I'm a little bit baffled by them, like, sticking to this, but, I mean, I'm assuming that you've read a number of these things, JR. Like, what would you say about, like, the actual comic book universe of cosmology or deities?
You know, it's really interesting how they all do this kind of stuff. They sort of just pretend that it's fine. Like, when you're reading a Wonder Woman comic, Ares and Zeus might all show up. But when you're reading a Justice League comic, they just don't really, and it's fine. like that's the thing, you can do that in comics, right? And again, all joking aside, I fully expect that that's what they do in this film universe. Well, and if they're smart, that's what they will do.
Yeah.
We're not going to see Ares in Justice League 4. Mm-hmm. We're not going to see a return of Zeus anywhere except possibly in a Wonder Woman sequel,
yeah.
Right? There might be another Greek god that shows back up who didn't get killed by Ares or whatever. So, and that's like, I'm cool with that. Right? Like, I don't need everything to be super coherent. I didn't need it in Marvel. Like, it's fine in Marvel. I worry sometimes they're handicapping themselves down the road. It's fine. Like,
well, in Marvel, the thing that I would say is similar to that is by having, how many Marvel movies there are now, like, over a dozen, obviously. The thing that they handicap themselves that you just kind of accept as a viewer is, wait, Iron Man has his own movie. Where are the rest of the Avengers? Like, doesn't...
Yeah, how come he didn't call them all when this happened? Right?
Oh,
and you don't care. Because the movie's called Iron Man, that's why.
Yeah, that's why. So when the movie's called Wonder Woman, you're going to expect there's mythology involved, but Zeus and the rest of them just don't care when Zod comes to town.
Because it's not that movie, right?
Because it's not that movie. So,
Well, I mean, it also, that sort of makes sense with Greek mythology, like actual Greek mythology, because they were, I mean, because they were kind of removed. Oh, they don't care. You know, they mess about in human affairs, but ultimately, I mean, they're terrible gods. I mean, if you look at them, I mean, they cause more problems than they do solve them. So. Mm-hmm.
Well,
so, do you really want them around? Not really.
Well, especially this version of them, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so with the understanding of kind of what Wonder Woman could symbolize or be synonymous with, especially like in the Christian realm, with the fact that the new improved DC Greek mythology, I feel like there's parallels to biblical narrative are there. There's not something that we have to jump through hoops to get to as people of faith, but still there's this kind of like final third act that we obviously have a problem with to some degree, but it's not just the action. I think for me, I have a little bit of a problem with maybe the message that I walked away with, at least initially. So I'm kind of curious what you guys would say is the final message of Wonder Woman. Like, I know, like, on a personal level, it's kind of inspirational to see some of the acts and see some of the things she does, but she has this kind of speech at the end, or this realization, and I thought it hit on similar notes to many other superhero movies I see, which is something I would call, like, idealistic humanist. So we all have good and bad, but the thing that will make the world a better place is if we all choose to be more good than bad. And, you know, I, especially hearing JR's retconning the end of the film, like I kind of do want more than just being idealistic humanist. Am I not seeing enough, or is there a final, like, again, what the final message of Wonder Woman? Did it strike you in a different way, Amber?
I mean, for me, essentially it did kind of come down to that, as far as like, okay, if this has, you know, if I'm going to boil it down to like this one simple message, you know, it is that this, her discovery, as it were, you know, that humans are both good and evil, you know, that both of those things exist, but that there is a choice. And, you know, we can choose good, and we can choose love, and we can choose, you know, we can choose those things. And not just in the big things too, in the little things in every day, and the people we interact with and how we interact with them, which I think we've already talked about, you know, how we see her doing that all throughout, and how she inspires other people to do that as well. So yeah, I kind of saw it, you know, on kind of that bigger level, but then on the smaller level too, in just those little smaller human moments, where we can choose to love those around us and to, try to lift them up. Which that essentially is what I found the most inspiring as well.
And I think that if there is something that is a particularly Christian message in the film, it's that you see people as their potential, not as their reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she said it was, it's not about what you deserve, it's about what you believe. Which she gets that from Steve Trevor, who is flawed, right? He's like, I am the smuggler, the thief, and the con man. I am the guy who's been fighting this war. I thought again, a powerful moment was when she learns that that Steve Trevor's people were just as bad to the chief's people, if not much worse, actually, than the Germans had been to the Belgium.
Right.
And so again, what he says is, it's not about what people deserve, it's about what you believe they can be. And now that in the film, as you're pointing out, Mikey, is like stripped away from any sort of transformative work of the spirit, which obviously as Christians, we would say is foundational for any sort of, like, that must precede any sort of transformation. But mm-hmm. I think in our churches, if we could actually approach people and treat them not as they deserve to be treated, but as we believe they could be, I think it would make a huge difference in the way we're perceived in our communities. And I think it would make a huge difference in how our cultures of our churches are interacting, you mm-hmm. know? Where I see in you the person God created, the image of God, and I act towards you as though that potential is already realized, which then in turn calls you into that. And you do that for me. Now, again, I think particularly as Christians, if we try to do that without that being grounded in the living and active work of the Spirit among the body of Christ, then it's just pointless self-help that doesn't actually work. Mm-hmm. But if we're speaking about what Christians do, yeah, then that's all predicated on movement of the Spirit among us and within us.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the caveat that I wanted to have to it.
But like, what would that have looked like in the film?
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think maybe a good step would have been, again, like, I just really, really falling in love with like your alternate ending where we save Ares, because we lean into her proclamation of love and what that looks like as a fully sacrificing, like, for everyone kind of love. Now, the problem with that is, and I admit that I'm probably going to butcher this because it was like three paragraphs of explanation and caveats and nuance that Elijah Lovejoy, who's been on the show a number of times, kind of posed as a question. And he said that at the end, you know, they talk about love. They're saying, like, love is the answer. Love is the answer. But, you know, when we don't define love, or we don't assume that love is God, and God, in what you're talking about, JR, like the Spirit, you know, without the Spirit, like us just trying to be better people is kind of futile. When we just say love is the answer, we are actually making the idea of love an idol. And love in and of itself is going to be flawed, and it's not going to be enough, because it's going to be the best we can choose or the best we can hope for, faulty people who have evil inside them trying to make the best choice, which is not always going to be the best choice. So we need something else. It's not just love, because like I said, that's that idealistic humanist, which is something that I want to point out. Like, I wish there were more idealistic humanists in general, because I think that's a good start. And I think that's kind of what you're pointing out as well, Jerry. You know, like, if we could see this, if we could start here, like in our churches and stuff, if that was a good starting point where we could see people as humans instead of like this label or that label or the worst thing they've done, if we could start there, that would be a great start. But, you know, if that's the ending, that's kind of problematic.
But love is not undefined in the film. Steve Trevor says, "I love you," and then he dies for everyone.
So, which I think would make more sense if she didn't say, you know, it's love, and then kill someone.
Oh yeah, no. Again, agree. Again, I think that ending totally butchered the point. But but I think that, I mean, that is the moment, because that's when she's standing with a tank over her head, ready to crush Dr. Poison.
Yeah.
Right.
So it only applies to humans, not,
well, and again, apparently. I think that's problematic.
Yeah.
But I know plenty of Christians that would agree with that.
Well,
and if you want to, you know, if they had wanted to sort of continue their Greek mythology theme, she could have done, you know, when Zeus defeated the Titans, he locked him away in a cage buried in the earth. Like, she could have done that with Ares. She could have locked him up in a cage underground.
Which even that's sort of like the lake of fire at the end of Revelation, right? Where the beast of the world is. Like, there is this sense, even in that reading of Christianity, where the devil has plenty of chances to knock it off and won't. And so God says, fine, you can do whatever you want. You're just going to do it over here.
Mm-hmm. And so they needed, Diana just needed to call up Thor and be like, hey, you know where you've been keeping Loki? Let's just put Ares there too. They can sit across from each other and talk all the schemey things they want.
And they can play checkers.
That's right.
Well, I'd watch that movie.
Right?
I'd watch that movie all day. Ares and Loki. Oh my gosh!
Like searching for Ares Fisher or something like that, or Bobby
Anything,
Ares.
Whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so you mentioned how JR, you mentioned how love was defined because of what Steve said to Wonder Woman at the end.
And it does.
And I am curious, and because this is a hypothetical, that hopefully start to wrap us up. Maybe, who knows? There's a lot to talk about. I was watching the How It Should Have Ended review of Wonder Woman earlier today, and the reviewer was actually saying that he was theorizing that Wonder Woman didn't actually hear the words that Steve said when he was saying goodbye. Because when, you know, the explosions are going on, mm-hmm. and we don't hear it. And so he was theorizing that the words we hear are only the ones we hear in her kind of like imagining of the situation. So is she just hearing the words that she believed were said because she wanted to believe the best about people? Because, you know, is that too far-fetched?
It's not far-fetched, but they don't give us any reason to doubt that Steve said any of that stuff. Mm. It's all 100% consistent with the character he is from the beginning of the film to the end.
Agreed.
So sure, maybe, but like, why doubt it?
Oh, well.
Right. No, I actually, you know, when you sent that, I read that and I was like, you know, I initially kind of had not quite that extreme, but I was kind of wondering, I was like, oh, I wasn't sure she could hear him. Did she hear him? Oh, I'm so glad she did, and I am going to choose to believe that absolutely he did say that, and she heard it.
Well,
that's what I would want to happen.
I like that answer, but it makes this entire question and answer section incredibly short, much shorter than I assumed it would be. But
you said fine. You wanted us to wrap it up, so I Amber did. And I put a lid on it.
Well, so in wrapping it up, something that I will point out after the organic groundswell of comments and feedback that I've been getting, I realized that I can no longer hold off having two of our segments that I thought people were seeing as exhaustive, but apparently they were some of people's favorite segments, which are our come on moments and our favorite moments from the film. So we all really enjoyed this film, to varying degrees, all fairly positively, but I know personally there were still some things, and apparently it's not very cool to do this. I do have an issue or two with the film, because I think it was not perfect. The bar was so low in DC, it felt like it could have been perfect.
Like, there were characters at the beginning that still acted the same way at the end. What is this movie I'm watching?
What?
This is crazy. So right now, from you guys, starting with you, Amber, was there anything that made you, during this film, say, come on?
Oh, yes. And when it happened, I even thought, oh, is Mikey going to ask about this? Because I know what it's going to be. Man, it was the last fight scene, and it was when she said, you know, it's not about what they, you know, it's not about what she deserves, but about beliefs, you know, what do you believe? I believe in love. I was like, mm-hmm. come on. Like, that felt so flat for me. And I would have been fine if she had said, like, if she'd made a list, even. If she had said, I believe in love, I believe in truth, I believe in good, I believe in justice. Like, you know, all of these things.
I believe in humanity. Yeah.
I believe in humanity. I believe in their power to rise above, you know, whatever.
I'm picturing her stopping this fight just to pull out, like, a list, like, from her brassiere or something, and be like, hold on one second.
She could have struck some blows in between, you know, itemized, you know, good things. I mean, work with me here. But I'm just saying, just that I believe in love, and that's supposed to be this big mirror before it's the big fight scene. And as a rule, usually the end fight scene is not my favorite. It's usually the ones that come in the middle, mm-hmm. Which was very true for this, and we can circle back to that with favorite moments. But mm-hmm. Because I'm more of a, I enjoy watching like hand-to-hand combat and weapons rather than the big visual effects. I mean, that stuff's fun, but, you know, it's not as intricate and interesting to me.
I don't think you're alone in that, so.
Okay. So you know, that already that's not going to be my favorite part, but you know, it's supposed to be this big, you know, it's the end, it's the climax, whatever. It's just, I believe in love. And I was just like, oh, okay.
Well, I mean, I think, in my opinion, to be fair, I think a lot of the lines that she had in the film said under different circumstances would have come off that way, but she was so idealistic and so hopeful, and so genuine that it's like, you know, when someone says something very obvious or whatever, you kind of, you don't give it a second look. You're like, that could be incredibly cynical, but there is no cynicism in how they're saying it, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
That said, I think that that line was like a little too far, considering. Yeah, I felt like there's a lot of leeway in the film for things that she said, but that one was.
No, I didn't. I mean, her other, like, I loved her performance. I loved that character. I love, you know, but that at that moment, just pretty much just that one, for her anyway. That was. Yeah, that was the one for me.
When I heard it, I actually had a picture of, like, Zack Snyder in the writer's room being like, this is it. You know, like, someone typing that out.
I fixed it, you guys.
Yeah, this is the line that people are going to say. And, you know, anytime someone writes that in the script, it's usually the worst line, you know? So I just had this mental flash in right there at the end of the film of whoever was writing it at the time, just going,
I had a flash of any number of really cheesy songs.
All you need is love, you know.
Now don't hate on the Beatles, but that is my least favorite. That's my least favorite Beatles song. But don't hate on the Beatles.
I'm not hating on the Beatles. It's just like, you know, things that come to mind, you know, like.
I know. But yeah, that's like my least favorite song of theirs ever. It's definitely my least favorite hit.
Oh, man. And a giant chest laser.
All you need is love.
And a giant chest laser. Good job, JR. All right. So, JR, you had some kind of come on moment during this film.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that. The Amber really took the best one.
Did I take it? I'm sorry.
No, I mean, there are others. You know, honestly, if I were going to point to other problems in the film, I hate when exposition is delivered in a clunky narrative, and that was basically the first 10 minutes of the film. Mm-hmm. Definitely the islands, the stuff on the Mascara was pretty choppy until the plane crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I mean, just purely from a storytelling perspective, it super annoys me when two life-altering events both happen simultaneously without any necessary cause.
Yeah.
So, like, the same moment that she crosses her gauntlets and reveals her power for the first time, and the moment that Steve's plane crash, like, why were those connected?
Right. We don't get to, like, sit with her for a minute.
Yeah, or like, that happened like 3 weeks ago, and she's been dealing with trying to figure out who she is, and her mom won't tell her, and blah, blah, blah. Or that's actually what caused the plane to crash. It was like the shockwave, or like, I don't know, like anything like other than just like these two completely random but uber significant plot events just so happen to happen at the same time.
Well, it's like in almost any other movie where, like, people are having a conversation. As soon as the conversation is over, like, the phone rings. Oh, that's him right there. Like,
Here's the next piece of plot we need to move on.
Yeah, I get that.
Right, again, minor annoyance. It's a thing that many movies do to speed the plot along.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if there was one other thing, it would be, like, this movie just barely passed the Bechdel test. Like, barely. And I was like, seriously? Come on. Like,
really?
You had an entire island of women for 15 minutes. Yeah, almost all they talked about was the world of men and the male gods. It did pass, but after they get off the island, there's only one other female character in the film who has any kind of significant speaking roles. And they do talk about shopping for clothes instead of men. But again, it's like two lines of dialogue that don't involve Chris Pine.
That's kind of crazy. Like, I didn't really think about it that way because I just kind of assumed the God talk was like amorphous talk. Like, it didn't matter that they were men they were talking about. They were talking about something that was...
I mean, Zeus and Ares are
definitely
males. Zeus is her daddy, and Ares is definitely a dude in the movie.
What about when they have talks about, like, hey, you need a trainer and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's great. There were a couple times. Like I said, it passed. But, like, still just barely.
I get,
and I was like, whoa, come on.
Well, it's one of the first things that Laura and I talked about when we left the theater. I was like, well, that one passed the Bechdel test right away. She was like, right?
Compare it to Mad Max Fury Road, which passed it like almost every time we turned around.
So I guess that was the thing, though. Like, when I was thinking of this movie passing the Bechdel test, I was thinking of like the spirit of the Bechdel test, not like the letter of the law of the Bechdel test. If that makes sense. Like I said, because when they were talking about like Zeus and Ares or like the world of men, I wasn't thinking about them being like, let's go to the world of men. Like, I bet there's sexy dudes there that we can date. Like,
it's still men occupying a central place in women's conversations.
Yeah. See, like I said, but that's the tough part. Cause again, I didn't see it as men. I see it as like, war or conflict. Like, they're just talking about people fighting, just happened to be men at the time.
I can see how it would come close, because she is dropped into this world. It is literally a world of men, because mm-hmm. at that time and at that place, definitely a man's world. And I mm-hmm. think it definitely sets up this very stark contrast between where she came from and where she ended up.
Yeah.
I agree.
That's tough. Well, I would say for me, something that I have harped on in my reviews and some of the conversations I've had is that I rarely mind things not looking real, but there were a couple things that happened in this film that I thought were very, very poorly done from a CGI standpoint. And lots of them happened early in the film, so I couldn't stop seeing them for the rest of the film. And for how well so many things in this film were done, it just kind of seemed lazy not to try to make them better. And like, there's a scene early where one of the Amazons, and it might be Robin Wright's character, like she like dismounts a horse like backwards or something, and it just looks so fake. It looks like she instantly becomes CGI. The scene where Diana jumps into the water, like, just, it looks so fake, like her actual jump. And then basically every time Wonder Woman jumps in the film, it just looked really bad to me. Not to even talk about again the third act, which just seemed kind of messy and odd with its effects and stuff. And like, when I think about like Batman versus Superman, like, you had a whole bunch of ridiculous things happen when they fought. But it was rare to see one of them interact with the environment and it not look like they were at least 90% really interacting with that environment. But, you know, Wonder Woman, like, especially when she like jumped through that wall, it just looked like it was, it just didn't look real. And not just because I've never seen a woman jump through a wall using a shield, but just because it like the angles and trajectories of like, it just looked weird and looked not real. And it took me out of the movie a lot of times. It was some of the only times in the movie I was like, I'm watching a movie. Something else that I'll say, and this is how I'm transitioning from come on to favorite moments, is that I had the thought in my head that this is going to be my come on moment. And that was when they were having the discussion about No Man's Land. Because they said, like, no man can cross that thing. And I immediately thought, like, everyone probably
does. Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, you have Eowyn. Yeah, you have that Lord of the Rings. You're like, well, I guess Wonder Woman's going to cross it.
I am no man.
Yeah, I expected her to say something corny like that. Like, well, fortunately, I'm no man. I'm a whoa man. And they're like, whoa, man.
Wow.
You know, and because, I mean, like, I'm like, how on the nose are they going to make this? And the reason it wasn't a come on moment is because they didn't do any of that.
Thankfully.
it turned into basically my favorite moment, because when she's, it wasn't while she was in No Man's Land. It was when she made the decision to go up that ladder.
Mm-hmm.
I had goosebumps, because I think
it told
us more about her character than almost anything else that she's done. Because she didn't have any craps to give at that point. She was like, "I'm doing what is right."
And she didn't know that she was a demigod.
Yeah,
she had seen Antiope die. And so she, it's not like she's Superman bulletproof, right?
Yeah.
Like she, as far as she knew, she might be walking to her death.
And it did not matter. So I went from eyes in the pre-roll position to chills running down my arm in the, you know, in the span of like 10 seconds. Yeah. And that was great to me. I mean, like, you know, and picking the No Man's Land scene in general for like a favorite moment, I think is pretty obvious, but like I said,
it was pretty safe, Mikey.
Yeah, pretty safe, but it's like I said, it's more than, or it's not just simply the No Man's, it's not like the action from her getting, you know, pelted with machine gun fire on her shield and kicking a tank. Like, that was great, but that wasn't my favorite part. The favorite part was how they turned that moment into something that wasn't cheesy or on the nose, and seeing the determination in that character want to physically do the right thing and act regardless of, just like a great example. And it was, like I said, it was chill inducing. And then, you know, all the scene that came after it was also fun, but it was that moment. So
yeah.
Amber, what was your favorite moment or moments?
Well, that was definitely one of mine. That whole No Man's Land scene is so great. And then, yeah, that moment in the trench where, you know, Steve's like, this is not what we came to do. And she's like, it's what I'm going to do. And then she goes out, you know, you're right. It's chill inducing. It's so good. And then of course, yeah, JR took another one, is the Charlie singing when she wants Charlie to sing. And then let's see, a few others were on Themyscira. I really enjoyed all the Amazon training segments just because that's fun. I really enjoy watching combat, even if it's only semi-real. It's really fun to watch, and, you know, choreographed fights and weapons training and all of that. You know, I was a huge fan of, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer in high school, and I mean, junior high. I mean, way younger. Oh, still now. Oh, my gosh. Still now. I love that show. Big fan of martial art, obviously, of martial arts. But even before I started training in martial arts, I was a fan. So, any kind of those, all those like choreographed fight scenes, I really enjoy those. So, nice. So you guys already talked about all of my favorites.
Well, you're welcome to talk about them again. There's no rule, no limitations on favorite scene chat. So,
I'm doubling down on the trench scene.
Okay.
I think everything from the moment she climbs out of the trench and we get the glorious reveal of her costume.
It's so awesome.
She's just celebrated. Like, there's just, it almost like freeze frames on her.
The music
hits.
And you
just get to, yeah. Well, no, the music doesn't hit in right there. It doesn't kick in until she smashes through the wall.
But it's like building.
It's building, yeah. But it doesn't, the actual theme, which is the sickest.
which I maybe was listening to on my commute today.
Yeah, I mean, over and over. Not, right?
On repeat.
and you live in LA, so that's like 4 hours each way, right?
Just on repeat.
No.
Until she lands in the church tower when they do the shield, which was like the best callback. That whole sequence is going to go down as one of the great superhero sequences of all time. Certainly one of the great superhero introductions of all time. I mean, I'm comparing it to like Batman Begins when he's in the shipping yard, to Iron Man when he first comes out of the cave. I think it blows them all away.
Yeah.
And then compare this to Man of Steel and Batman v Superman, where Superman is always like, when she stands up at the top of the church, I was like, well, they freaking did it again. Good job. You have these characters who save people, but then just stand far and distant and like, almost like they can't decide. I mean, this is explicitly Superman. He can't decide whether he actually cares about people or not. Cause he had terrible parents that Zack Snyder murdered. And then the very next thing that happens is she's down on the ground, like hugging, embracing, shaking hands, laughing. And I was like, yes, like this is a DC superhero. This is a DC superhero. Is everyone paying attention? this is a DC superhero. It was perfect.
Oh, I remembered something else that I really enjoyed. It was another favorite thing.
Wow, how convenient it was that JR just finished talking when you remembered that you needed to say something else.
Well, JR helped. What? It was following that scene, immediately following that scene, when they're in the village and kind of celebrating with the people, you know, then Steve asks her to dance and they're dancing and she asks him, you know, like, oh, so is this what people do when they're not fighting in a war, essentially? And I liked that because I feel like, again, going back to her, encouraging other people's humanity and to be their best selves. I think that's what she is encouraging and fostering in other people all the time. It's like, okay, you are not defined by this war. You know, I want to know who you are as a human. You know, she asks Samir who he was, you know, he's like, oh, I wanted to be an actor and all of this. And then, you know, she wants Charlie to sing, you know, she's trying to help them not just get out of the war as an end the war, but not be defined by it and totally overcome by it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, so that's one of the reasons that I really appreciated the script, or at least the story. And as much as I think we can bag on Zack Snyder for a lot of well-deserved things, like the steps in this story, every time they have an opportunity, they are consistently making Diana, like I said, changing the people around her and encouraging the best parts of humanity in every scene. It's almost like they're squeezing it in every time they have a chance, and it's consistent. Mm-hmm. And I think it brought it brought humanity. It brought like a soul to the actual film. It didn't feel cold and distant, you know? So, well, with that, I want to give you guys one last chance, because I know, again, this movie actually has a lot of things going on, and we hit on probably lots of the biggest and most popular parts, but I wanted to make sure you guys had a chance to say anything else that we didn't get a chance to touch on. So, Amber, do you have any final thoughts / recommendations or anything about the film?
I think I hit on everything, all of my notes, but, I did want to share one of my, again, I did a lot of reading about this. But I wanted to share, a tidbit from Entertainment Weekly. Chris Nashawaty. Sorry, dude, about your name.
Thanks for listening, Weekly by writer. The way.
Big fan. Love to have you on the show.
Yeah, that's right.
Entertainment Weekly wrote how deliciously ironic that in a genre where the boys seem to have all the fun, a female hero and a female director are the ones to show the fellas how it's done. I enjoyed that quote a lot.
Yeah, I feel like at least in the DC universe, that does seem to be the case. It's hard. I mean, like I said, we've already started having these arguments in the discussion group, but I feel like it's very hard to argue against that. So, JR, is there anything that we didn't hit on or that you just wanted to mention about the film before we
close up? No, I'm genuinely curious. Patty Jenkins has already said that Wonder Woman 2 is happening in America. Mm-hmm. So I assume that we're not going to have another, like, a World War II movie or something like that. So really curious to see what happens next.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that I'm enjoyed Wonder Woman enough that no matter how much of a steaming pile of dung heap Justice League parts 1 and 2 are, I will still enjoy the heck out of Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm not trying to take us on another tangent, but no. Did you read, one of the articles you sent had some, I think it was one of the ones you sent, had some, like, internet. First of all, people on the internet are mean. but it makes me sad. But there were comments when she was cast that were just so mean, mm-hmm, about her casting. And I was like, you know what? she was amazing. Can we just pause and just say how amazing she was as Wonder Woman? Yeah. She did a fantastic job. And
well, I think she probably didn't have enough a lot of exposure before, and so people were doubtful because, you know, like you cast Batman, you get Ben Affleck. Everyone knows who Ben Affleck is. They might doubt him because they've actually seen him in too much. You know, Gal Gadot is that actual opposite of that. You know, they didn't see her enough. They're like, oh, she's in Fast and Furious. Can she really hang as Wonder Woman? Can she even act? You know, and I think that actually helped her a lot because we're not superimposing like some other, like all these other characters that she's played onto
Wonder
Woman.
Well, and that's what I think. What I always feel like, and from what I've seen, when you're casting a super iconic character and one that people know, I feel like it's better to go with someone who's newer or who's just less familiar to people, so they don't have all of these kind of preconceived ideas about that actor.
Yeah, I think it says a lot about the actor when they can overcome those things, but it does seem like a lot easier for them to just start fresh. I mean, like, I had not really, that I'm aware of, seen Henry Cavill in basically anything. And when he showed up as Superman, I was like, man, he is a good-looking Superman. Like, everything that I imagined Superman would probably be, that's that guy right there. Now, what they did with him after that, like I said, some people like it, some people don't.
Right.
But, I mean, I was like, yeah. Like, I'm not thinking, oh, that's Henry Cavill from The Thing. But at the same time, it's I think pretty commendable when someone can have something in the past and then overcome it, because I remember when they said that gosh, there's so many Chris's. Chris Evans. So when Chris Evans was cast as Captain America, I was like, the Human Torch, god, that was terrible. Like, how are they going to cover up the fact that he was the Human Torch in that awful, awful Fantastic Four movie? And he crushed it. I mean, like, he is, it's hard for me to imagine anyone ever playing Captain America but him, because it's just so, it seems so perfect. And now I think it's going to be, I think, kind of hard for Gal to actually get a different job, because everyone's going to see her as Wonder Woman.
Right. Well, and that's the flip side of landing one of those big iconic roles.
Yeah.
Is, you know, how do you break off of that then? Yeah. You know, professionally speaking.
Well, if there's nothing else that you guys have, I wanted to mention this one thing. We talked about how this movie is, you know, like, kind of quote marks a success, and you measure that in a lot of different ways, but Wonder Woman. I'm trying to quote this thing. It soared to number one at the box office on its opening weekend, earning an estimated $100.5 million domestically and $122 overseas for a $223 million global total. And that basically set a record, which is great. It's not only great because it's cool to see this film do very well. Just great because it's nice to see Patty Jenkins kind of take over the number one spot. For some reason that I feel like I should be able to articulate, but I can't, it makes me exceptionally happy that a film like this, with a character like this, with messages like this, that have inspired so many like this, beat the previous record holder for a female director. Because that previous record holder was the
50 Shades of
Grey, 50 Shades of Grey. And so for some reason, it just makes
me... I'm so glad this beat that out.
Yeah, so now we don't have to
ew.
Remember all the accomplishment of female directors, like when they made tons of money making 50 Shades of Grey? And I kind of go,
yeah,
cringe-worthy. Now I feel like I can
female say... Female empowerment, y'all.
Yeah, I feel like I can say, hey... Now the one that has, you know, made the most money, the female director that has been most successful at the box office, at least in those terms, is no longer 50 Shades of Grey. It's Wonder Woman, a film that is literally inspiring, most of the people, if not almost all the people who have seen it. So as opposed to probably what 50 Shades of Grey was inspiring or whatever. Anyway, so that's my final thought. If you haven't seen Wonder Woman, you should probably go see it. If you've got young daughters, you should probably take them to see this movie, because
if you've got old daughters, you should probably take them to see this movie.
In general, if you have any women in your life, it's probably a good idea to take them to see this film, because I think it's, even if they're not really into superhero films, I think they'll enjoy this film.
And actually, a female pastor friend of mine said that she really enjoyed watching the film with her 10-year-old son, and mm-hmm. was very thankful to be able to share that experience with him as well, so...
Mm. Yeah, but no one cares about boys. They have enough things. We don't need to teach them anything. let's just let culture teach them what they need to know.
Oh boy.
No, I don't mean that in any way. That's a great point. Well, with that, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I have no idea how long this is actually going to be. But this was something I've been looking forward to. I know that we had a lot of people. I don't know why people think that, like, I don't plan these shows out in advance. But there's lots of people being like, hey, man, I don't suppose I could be on Wonder Woman. I was like, I've had Wonder Woman planned for months, y'all. But I'm glad that I had you two on. I'm glad that, you know, we could record at this random time, which people don't care about because they're not listening in live. But you guys could both be here. Amber, thank you. JR, thank you. And I want to make sure that people can follow the work you're doing and continue conversations with you if they've really take into something or love something that you guys have said and want to continue this conversation. So, Amber, what do you do? And how can people engage with that or interact with it or follow it?
What do I do? I do a lot. well, for one thing, you can read my movie reviews on realworldtheology.com. I, you know, write about new movies. I write about classics. I think I'm going to be doing some stuff for Rewind here later this year. So all kinds of different movies. And yeah, love to find me that way. And then other than that, I do art, which you can see on both Instagram and Tumblr. And it's just my name, Amber Kennison. That's my handle on Instagram. And then it's also amberkennison.tumblr.com.
Nice. And we'll make sure we have those notes in the show notes. JR, do you do anything at all that people might be interested in following?
I do a couple things. I have several other podcasts. You can find it at novarogers.com/podcasts. I do a weekly pop culture and scripture digest email that I send out every Friday that has a bunch of pop culture picks, recommendations, and then some scripture reflection. And it also conglomerates all of the things I do on the internet, puts them in one easily accessible place, like this will be on this week's email. And then that I also have a book coming out in November from InterVarsity Press called Empathy for the Devil, where it's about what we can learn from the bad guys in the Bible and gals. So, and all that information gets filtered through my newsletter also. So yeah.
I'm glad you put it that way, because remember, girls can be bad too. Hashtag feminism.
That's right.
Oh, I was going to say hashtag Jezebel, but
she's one of them. Actually. She's one of them.
She definitely is.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things that, I mean, for anyone who watches John Oliver, which I'm sure is not all of our audience, but those are some of my favorite jokes that he does. Anytime he talks about something like ironic that women also do, he's like, because women can be evil too, you know, hashtag feminism. because it's funny on lots of levels. Anyway, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter if you'd like to have more bad and terrible and unfunny observations. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by going to realworldtheology.com/support, and you can see all the ways that we are currently in need of your help to continue to make amazing shows like this one, because I just call this show amazing. Boom. and always, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. And when you do that, wherever you can, please rate and review the show. We love 5-star reviews. It is more helpful than you probably know, especially if you are not a podcaster. like I said, it just really, really helps for various reasons. So if you have just a couple seconds, 5 stars is great. Writing a small review is even better. So thank you for listening. Thank you for rating and reviewing the show. There's been a couple new ones and I forgot to write your names down, so I didn't give you a shout out. And this would have been a great one, cause I know so many people are going to listen to this episode.
Bobby,
Sharon,
and Sally. Yeah. I'm guessing.
Oh, it's like that scene in What Hot American Summer where Janine Garofalo is walking around the camp, just randomly making up Jewish sounding names. Oh, it's so good. If you haven't seen What American Summer, you should. Unless, of course, you have a problem with some kind of... Anyway, it's hard for me to recommend movies because we have such a diverse audience. Anyway, point being, that's a hilarious scene. I have rambled for quite a while now, but the most important thing that I want you to leave with is to know that for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that a story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Microphone check, 1, 2, 1, 2. I said a microphone check, 1, 2, 1, 2.
All right. Hey, who wants to help name this show?
Ooh.
Wonder Woman and Kryptonian Xenomorphs.
See, we didn't quite get into that enough.
No, but I put it on Facebook.
Oh, you did?
So it makes it true.
Aaron White was like, I can't wait to hear the context of that. And I was like, bro, sorry, this is the context.
This is it.
This is the context.